This is Tape 7, Side A of the Open University course, English 102, Composition in Native Indian Literature 1. On this tape, course author Patty Hartford talks to Jeanette Armstrong, the author of This is a Story. This interview was recorded at the Open Learning Agency in Burnaby on February 12, 1993. Jeanette Armstrong is at the Anaukin International School of Writing in Penticton, B.C., and Patty Hartford is at her home in Kamloops.
So tell me, what is it that made you decide to become a writer?
For me, it wasn't a conscious choice. I don't think one chooses to be something like a writer or an artist. I think that it chooses you, basically, and you find a way to cope with it. I think part of the training that I had in relation to the traditional oral stories had a lot to do with that.
You were taught stories from the time you were very young?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And were you actually trained to tell them, to be sort of a guardian of the stories?
Not in the rigid sense that may be implied. I was exposed to a number of oral storytellers at a very young age. The earliest one I remember is an old blind lady called Mary, and she and her sister, she would be accompanied by her sister, who was sort of her eyes, to my parents' home. They would stay for maybe 3 or 4 days, and every night would be storytelling night. And we lived out in sort of a wilderness area away from the rest of the community, and so there wasn't any other people or children around, and other than my brothers and my one sister. And so we had no electricity, and the cool oil lamps would be put out early, and this usually in the winter time, fall and winter. And then we would listen to stories for 2 or 3 hours, and I'd fall asleep listening to stories, and she would continue telling them for, you know, as long as people were awake. And that was a really common experience when I was very young, like just learning to speak. And of course they were in my language. And then there were two men later who also, after I became a little older, they're old men. One of them was Casimir Pierre, who came and would stay with us for months. And myself and my little brother he told us, he would say to us, you put these stories away in this little box, and he'd tell us, I'll show you where the little box is in your mind. And, you know, give us a technique, as you know, in terms of remembering them. And so he was actually a teacher. And I learned many stories from him from the time I was about school age, I guess, till I was about 10 or 11 years old. And then from there, there were three other storytellers. There was Harry Robinson, who's, you know, somewhat well known in the English transliterations that have been done by the anthropologist Wendy Wickwire.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was a storyteller, but he taught us in Okanagan from the time I was in my puberty years till I was, till I was a mother of, you know, two children. I continued, hearing and sitting with him. He would call me from Karamuse and tell me, this is after he was unable to travel. But when he was traveling, he would come to our home and stay for days. And it was the same way with old man Lazard. He would call us to his home. And there were about six of us that he worked with. There was his own granddaughter, Donna Lazard, and one of his sons, Sandy Lazard, Clara Jack, myself, and Eileen Paul. And he would call us periodically, about once every 3 or 4 weeks, and we would gather at his house. And then those were a different level of stories. Those were the, I guess you could say, the stories that are attached to the understanding of our ceremonies and our worldview, and I don't like to use the word religion, but in terms of the natural world and our practice of spirituality within that natural world. And so he was one of my mentors, I guess, in the sense that you could say a storyteller is given some keys to work with beyond the practice or crafting of stories.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one was my uncle, who was from Inchlin, Washington. He's a really well-known storyteller. He travels up and down the valley and was recorded by a number of people. And is still, you know, still living and is still telling stories. And I visit him once or twice a year and exchange stories with him. So that's the background. And in Morning Dove was his aunt, or my mother's brother, and that's my mother's aunt.
I sense when I talk to you and in some of the things that I've read that you've written that you just have a real love for these stories and for the people who tell them. Then I read some of your other things, like Slash, and I sense a different kind of feeling here. When you write, do you write often consciously about things that happen to you personally, about people you know?
Well, I'm not certain that it's an entirely conscious process for any type of writing, because you're drawing on a number of issues that lie at the subconscious level whenever you're involved in any art form or a form of communicative expression. But in terms of use of specific in relation to the construction that's on the page with the novel and with prose, you do have to be more intellectually conscious in terms of how you're creating the story and to what end and purpose that you're creating that story. And so with something like Slash, I did spend time looking and researching and thinking about how I could articulate some of those things that were of concern to my generation.
Was there some Jeanette Armstrong in Slash? Were you involved in the activist movement?
I've been involved deeply in the activist movement since I was a child, and I think that was instilled by my family and those teachers of those stories. I have always understood from my parents very clearly the rights of our people to have a language and a culture and an identity, and to resist the, I guess, onslaught of the dominant society to terminate our culture and our language and our worldview and our understanding of how we, you know, how we as Native peoples interact with each other and with the rest of the world. And I guess in that sense I have always, even as a child, I experienced frustration and experienced rage and experienced anger whenever I came up against the intolerance by dominant society in terms of Native peoples. And that definitely is there in Slash. I mean, there's no question about that.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is the most important thing for Native people to write about?
I think that's a question that only can be answered in a general sense, because of its generalist nature in relation to Native peoples. There isn't one sort of monolithic culture of Native peoples. So there's a number of First Nations groups who form different cultures, and they, in terms of looking at their traditions and looking at their contemporary sense of how they, as a people, survive and live and find beauty and joy and express that and relate that to one another, communicate that to one another, is what they need to be writing about. And part of that is how, you know, how that identity comes into contact, of course, with Canadian society. And it's important that there be some way to reflect that back, to interpret that back in much the same way any literary canon reflects back to its audience, what its society is about and what its thinking is. And so that's a very necessary process in relation to those First Nations peoples and their cultural interpretation of their process related to a dominating or domineering society around them. And in terms of the social impact, it's very critical because there is always a sense of loss and the sense of identity and the sense of anger. And there needs to be a way of communicating to one another in terms of resolvement. And so I think in any case that is always a part of a literary tradition.
What is your feeling about non-Native writers writing fiction about Native people?
Well, I think that there's a couple of questions that those writers must think about, need to think about. One of the serious questions around the whole question is how stereotyping of Native peoples, First Nations peoples, has occurred throughout the colonizing period, and what the that myth-making of those writers, what part that has played. And I think that there needs to be some ethics around how you project a stereotype in relation to a people, because there has been so much damage done through the stories that have been written and passed on, and through things like the Western movies that, you know, have created horrible images of Native peoples in everyone's minds that came up through the period in which, you know, everyone watched Westerns. And it's not until you're on my side of the fence and you experience, you know, kids hopping around you and, you know, and war whooping and, you know, and asking you where your feathers are, and then you realize in the media, you know, whenever there's an Indian resistance to, you know, to take away their land and they put up a roadblock, that all of a sudden it's the same image in everybody's mind, that, you know, these are war-whooping Indians ready to kill, you know, and storm the wagons again. And it is very damaging. And when you create that kind of mythology and you create, or even the opposite end of that, the noble savage kind of figure, that is very damaging to those peoples who are already coping with so much in terms of lies about them. And so it's not a question of the right of people, you know, in terms of freedom of expression and writing. It's really a question in relation to those peoples who are affected by it, and the right of people to continue to create lies and myths about those people.
Who are some of your favorite writers?
I guess one of my favorite writers has been Hemingway in the past, and has, you know, for me created a sensibility in terms of approach to writing prose. In terms of poetry, that has come from my own people, and I've also the Romantic poets. I guess during the Romantic period, I would think that Shelley, mostly, in terms of the rhythm that Romantic poetry has, and that sensibility that comes from our own oral poetry, there's a sensibility there for me that I find that is a parallel. But in terms of what I enjoy reading, actually I the genre that I enjoy reading is science fiction. And so, you know, the people like Frank Herbert or Ursula Le Guin have excited me in terms of the way that they create fiction worlds to talk about social issues and political issues, environmental issues, and so on. One of my favorite works may be Ursula Le Guin's Always Coming Home. that in particular was striking to me.
This surprises me, and I think it's fascinating, this interest in science fiction. I know that you have done a great deal of work in different areas. You've worked with a great number of genres. What do you think is your best work?
I don't have it written yet.
Oh.
But as far as the works where I think I've accomplished some of the sort of studies, and I suppose all works are studies in that sense, is probably the book of poetry, Breath Tracks,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, I actually have gone beyond just working with the crafting part of it, but actually felt that I was communicating with the medium.
Okay. I know that people, critics, have looked at your work, written about you and about your work. What kinds of things do they say?
Most of the critical analysis has been done around the prose that I write, slash I haven't seen a lot of critical work on Breath Tracks, because it is, of course, been more recent. It was only last year that I published it. One of the things that I have seen a number of papers and essays published about slash. One of the things about it is its difference in terms of use of language and format, and also the development in terms of the narrative itself, and how it's not developed in a linear fashion. And the process that I use to develop character, as well as also one of the areas that is spoken about.
I understand that you revised slash. You, after a first edition, you made a revision. Is that correct?
It was a very slight revision. It wasn't anything major. There was one section which I basically tightened up, really. There was a couple of scenes that I presented that were repetitive.
Was that in response to critics?
No, that was in collaboration with the editor that I was working with. He had mentioned it to me to think about it. In the revision part, I looked at it and I did agree with him, and it was very clear to me. And going back to it, and you can't continuously revise, but that part was clear to me that I had approached those scenes in a different way, in a different chapter.
Okay. We'd really like to have you read from This Is a Story, just any passage you'd like, and then maybe we could talk a little bit more about your work and the story itself. Maybe go for a couple of pages, just where you find a normal breaking point would be fine. Or, you know, if you want to start later and go to the end,
okay,
that's up
I'll
to you.
I'll read a little bit from the beginning.
Okay.
It came to me one morning early, when the morning star was up shining so big and bright, the way she does in the summers. It was during the women's gathering at Owl Rock. It was the same year that the red star came so close to the earth that it was mentioned in the papers. I'd been setting up with a fire. One woman had to set up with it at all times during the gathering. One friend had stayed up with me to help keep me awake. It had been cold, and I was wrapped up in a Pendleton blanket. It was the second to last night of the gathering. I was getting very sleepy when George said, "Tell me a story." "Okay," I said. "This story happened a long time ago. It's real." Coyote was coming up the river from the Great Columbia River up to the Okanagan River. Coyote had come up through there before, one time before that I know of. That time Coyote came up the Okanagan River, which runs into the Columbia River. That was the time when Coyote brought salmon to the Okanagan. everywhere coyotes stopped at the people's villages, families left. It made everyone happy. It was a great gift. Coyote did that a long time ago. Now, after waking up from an unusually short nap, Coyote was walking along upstream, wanting to visit with the people in the Okanagan. These were Coyote's favorite people. Visiting them always meant a real feast with salmon. Coyote was partial to salmon. While walking along, Coyote noticed a lot of new things. A lot of things had changed since that last trip through here. There sure were a lot of swallow people. And they had houses everywhere. But Coyote couldn't find any people, or even the villages of the people. Things looked very strange. Okay, I'm going to move on from there. 132.
Okay.
Coyote tried to talk to some of the head men. Coyote would suggest something like, "You should break them swallow dams and let the salmon come back. They know where to come. They never forget. I told them not to. You shouldn't eat that swallow food. Look at all the sick people." Actually, Coyote himself was getting pretty sick and gaunt from eating stuff that didn't taste or look like food, especially real food like fresh salmon. But the head man would just shake his head and say, "Get out of here, Coyote. Your kind of talk is just bullshit. If you say them things, people will get riled up. They might even start to raise hell. They might even try to do something stupid like break the dam. Them swallows, they get mad real easy. Besides, we'll just end up looking stupid. We got to work with them now, even if we don't exactly like what they do. We got to survive. We got to get money to buy food and other things. We got to have jobs to live. That's how it is now. We can't go back to old times. We need them swallows. They're smart. They know lots that we don't know about. They know how to live right. We just got to try harder to be like them. So get out of here. You're not real anyway. You're just a dream of the old people." They would say things like that, even while they talked right face to face to Coyote, even when Coyote was right there in front of them. Coyote would walk on feeling real bad. Coyote had seen lots of people in really bad shape. They walked around with their minds hurt. They couldn't see or hear good anymore. Their bodies were poisoned. They didn't care much for living anymore. They thought they were swallows. But they couldn't figure out why the swallows taunted and laughed at them. They couldn't seem to see how the swallows stole anything they could pick up for their houses. How they took over any place and shitted all over it, not caring because they could just fly away to another place. They couldn't seem to see that the swallow treated them just as they pleased, without any respect. Coyote could see then that them swallows were still a monster people. They were pretty tricky, making themselves act like they were people, but all the while underneath, being really selfish monsters that destroy people and things like rivers and mountains. Now Coyote could see the reason for being awakened early. There was work to be done. It was time to change the swallows from monsters into something that didn't destroy things. Coyote was Coyote, and that was the work that Coyote had to do. Fair enough?
That's wonderful. That was a great passage, and I like that shift there, too, from the beginning to that second part. That's great. One of the things that I wondered as I read the story first was the setting of the story, the women's conference, the sort of story within a story, and the whole scene at Owl Rock. Is this something that often does take place, women's conferences and this kind of situation?
It is, yeah. It's happening most of the communities, Native communities, in one way or another are returning back to communicating with each other and helping one another, supporting one another in what we call the healing circles, which is really people expressing to one another and moving away from the alienation that seems to be prevalent in this society and seems to affect all people. But in our communities, you'll find that almost every community is going through this transformation and re-establishing the traditional ways that a community would actively, I guess, involve its members in interpreting for them and making sense of the world around them. And so that would be, it isn't unique. In the setting in terms of Owl Rock is, you know, you could recreate that setting almost in any Native community across the country.
The first sentence of the story, it came to me one morning early, and then we move directly into the setting. Then at the end of the second paragraph, the narrator responds, "This story happened a long time ago. It's real." The first sentence suggests that this is sort of a fabrication. The second passage suggests that this is actually reality. Is there a conflict there?
No. What I was working with is the format of traditional story, oral story, in the Okanagan style of storytelling. And that is to create a subconscious connection to the past and to what you people call the mythology in terms of story characters in the present tense, and destroying the barriers of past, present, and future so that the story is like fluidly moving between those realities and involves all those realities at the same time in the same story. And it becomes a very powerful experience in terms of the listener in being involved in an old story, but the story is a contemporary story and very relevant to the contemporary issues or concerns or problems that is being addressed in that story.
Was this a conscious effort on your part to incorporate the Native storytelling style into a modern story with modern issues?
Well, yes. I mean, that's the traditional oral story is an art form, and it's a performed art form which uses that format to engage the listener and involve the participant, the listener as a participant in the story, where you don't have the immediacy of the audience in terms of a listener. And you're working with a written format, in other words, a page, and someone's going to read that. Therein is where my problems in terms of working that out and seeing how it might work as a technique, as a crafting technique, is what I'm challenged with. And working with that, this story, I felt, worked to some degree in that sense. Although I'm not entirely happy with, I could have taken it further, and of course there are stories that I'm working on now that is pushing that, pushing the limit in terms of the format.
Was this your first attempt at this format?
No, actually I'd written a number of stories that I was somewhat happy with, but not happy enough to send for publication.
You've worked with a variety of literary genre. What's your favorite? Or do you have one?
No, not at this point. I have a hard time with the categorization. I'm serious about that, and I really don't. I'm not in sympathy with categorization in terms of communicative arts that emerge from words. I think the word's at the bottom of it, and how you use the word as you would a material is really what is exciting to me. And so all of these different genres are simply crafting techniques that give sensibility in terms of how the word may be used.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about your work at the Anelkin Center, because I think this probably blends very well with what your vision is as a writer. How did the Anelkin Center get started?
The center actually has been is around for quite a while, although it wasn't called initially Anelkin Center. When I returned from university in Victoria in 1978, the beginnings of it was already in place in a sense, in that after the closure of the Department of Indian Affairs offices, this is a political closure of the district Indian offices, there was a series of meetings that took place by the Okanagan people with their leaders. And when I say leaders, I don't mean just the political leaders. I mean the elders and the storytellers and the people who were in the arts and people who were involved in various areas of success. We were called together in 1977. We had a series of meetings to determine the priorities for returning control of our lives to our people. And education was one of the was the priority, and we decided collectively that education did not mean schooling in the public school sense, and that very little education was actually happening there in terms of its relevancy to our lifestyle, our worldview, and our processes in our communities. That in fact it was, you know, part of the problem. And so the Okanagan Indian Curriculum Project was one of the first active instruments that was constructed by the chiefs of the bands collectively. They appointed a number of people who was the Okanagan Indian Education Committee, and we were given the instructions to do whatever was necessary and whatever we wanted to do to pull together all the cultural information we needed and decide and figure out how we were going to return it back to our people through the educational process. And so that project became multifaceted in terms of education of children. Principally, we looked at how are children learning today. The children are learning through written materials and through video and film and those kind of artistic materials that could be used. So there was a development phase in which a lot of that material following the research phase was pulled together into children's books and used in curriculum. And the writing school actually resulted out of the gathering of all those materials. A lot of other areas besides the Okanagan wanted some of the materials that we had. And so publishing and printing became sort of an outcrop of that ability to move some of that information outward. And so Thetis Books came into being. And once Thetis was in place as a publishing house, and its mandate, and it's owned by a nonprofit educational society, its mandate was to publish and promote Native thought, Native culture, correct stereotypes, and provide the public with quality information, then it became a question of how to maintain a number of writers to provide materials that could be published yearly. So one of the things we found out early was that there wasn't a lot of thinking in Canada about Native literature, and it was hardly recognized as being anything of any consequence. And it was a conscious decision to begin looking at the Native art form in terms of literature and to look at ways that we could develop that. And so the writing school came about because of that. But after we had met with, and I'm saying we, it's not a personal endeavor, but a number of us, we met with a number of writers from the United States and Canada. We sat down and actively said, okay, what should the school do? And how should it proceed? And so that's principally what we're carrying out now.
What kind of numbers do you have in terms of enrollment in the writing
school? We always
school?
Maintain a small set of numbers per class because of the individualized instruction that we feel is necessary to work with writers to develop them as individual artists. So usually each of our classes have anywhere from 5 to 15 students at the most. And I think we have 5, 8, 9 courses running. So altogether you have not any more than 35 students, 40 students any given year.
Sounds like a wonderful program.
Mm-hmm.
I just have one last question here in terms of the story itself. This is a story. What advice would you give to a student who is about to read This Is a Story?
Well, simply that the story is patterned after the classical oral tradition of storytelling. And that means it's narrated, and that means that the narrator is able to engage the listener very specifically in terms of what the message in the story, in the internal story is. And so in this story, the narrator, of course, is there present, because I can't be present. And I guess that's probably the sense of breaking down the barriers between the past, present, and future, and presenting the story in a way which involves all three realities.
Okay. I think that the students will appreciate that, and I know from having discussed the story in classes in the past with Native students that they are thoroughly thrilled by it and really appreciate the allegorical nature of the story. It's something that maybe to varying degrees they recognize the allegory throughout, but as they came to the realization of what was actually occurring here, they got really excited about it, and so obviously its merit using this storytelling technique is certainly important and relevant to students everywhere, I suppose, Native and non-Native students alike.
Well,
so I thank you very much.